Does Life or Death Govern the Universe? The Metaphysics of Geopolitics, Part 1, by Matthew Arrett. Is human society destined for self-annihilation, or were we made for something better? Certainly if one listens to the transhumanist gospel by modern pseudo-religious cult leaders like the WEF's Yuval Noah Harari, Google's Ray Kurzweil, or perennial spiritual atheist Sam Harris, it might appear that the soulless computer program, that is, the human machine, is merely a hackable computer whose code will be cracked any day now. The universe described by these high priests of atheism, who profess to know of the beginning, end, and extremes of everything, is a closed system winding down into a supposed heat death, which we are told will inevitably wrap its cold, meaningless hand around everything in a nihilistic big whimper. But is this nihilistic projection true? It certainly appears to be founded upon centuries, if not millennia, of scientific thought which has led us inexorably towards these dismal conclusions. So how would we go about trying to prove to ourselves whether or not there is a bigger piece of the story being left out by forces that would prefer it if nihilism were the only conclusion we could possibly arrive at? Let's explore this question in a bit more detail. Aristotle's slave-master society. Throughout history, a dispute has raged between two opposing paradigms, each attempting to infuse very different meanings into fundamental concepts like human nature, law, freedom, justice, and God. Where one paradigm has tended to look upon the universe as a living process, animated by creative growth and a loving creator in whose image humankind was made, the other paradigm has tended to approach things somewhat differently. If scientific thought is relegated to the material domain alone, then such transcendental concepts as soul, truth, causality, design, and intention have very little value beyond whatever utilitarian desires and elite wishes be imbued into these words at any given moment in time and space. Such an arbitrary idea of freedom and truth was demonstrated by the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, who posited that human nature was forever destined to be controlled by a master class of elites presiding over a slave class. In his Politics, Part 5, Aristotle explicitly lays out this view with the sophistication of a racist hillbilly, explaining that since it is evident that his particular society embraced slavery, it were obvious that slavery were built into the fabric of the universe itself. Think I'm exaggerating? Ask Aristotle, who said, quote, "Is there anyone thus intended by nature to be a slave, and for whom such a condition is expedient and right? Or rather, is not all slavery a violation of nature?" There is no difficulty in answering this question on grounds both of reason and of fact, for that some should rule and others be ruled is a thing not only necessary, but expedient. From the hour of their birth, there are some who are marked out for subjection, others for rule. End quote. Unlike the elder Plato, who strove always for the unifying principle behind all definitions, Aristotle's world is much more fragmented. After establishing his master-slave dichotomy as a self-evident truth that only fools would question, Aristotle goes on to build up an explanation that there are as many divergent definitions of virtue and justice as there are statuses in society. For the virtue of a slave could never be equivalent to the virtue of a master, and the justice of a tyrant could never be the same as a justice for a subject. Despite the fact that mythmakers have maintained a lie for centuries, which asserts without any authentic evidence that Aristotle merely advanced Plato's ideas, any honest reading of the works of both men demonstrate two irreconcilable paradigms. More than simply having divergent views of definitions, the ways of thinking about thinking itself are mutually incompatible. Aristotle's blank slate and impotent God. While Plato demonstrates the superior mental powers of an uneducated slave boy to the so-called superior genetic breeding of the oligarch Mino, Aristotle defends the idea that slavery is immutable. Plato's proof, outlined in the Meno, Phaedo, Gorgias, and Philebus, rests upon the demonstrable existence of an immortal soul which must exist for discoveries of universals in nature to be possible. Aristotle, on the other hand, posits throughout his writings that no such pre-existent soul with any immortal character need be assumed to exist, since we are all nothing but blank slates to be written on by material experiences. In his De Anima, Aristotle states, quote, "When we said that mind is in a sense potentially whatever is thinkable, though actually it is nothing until it has thought, what it thinks must be in it just as characters may be said to be on a writing tablet on which as yet nothing stands written. This is exactly what happens with mind. If the mind is bound to the impressions caused by the senses alone, with nothing innate or immortal pre-existing within a child, then truth again becomes reduced to relativism. This must be so, as nothing universal or eternal is knowable through the finite and limited senses, for we can see one or many humans, but we cannot see humanity, which remains an abstract idea devoid of any principled meaning in this world view." End quote. Extending his lifeless utilitarianism beyond considerations of mere humanity, Aristotle goes on to posit that the universe itself is 1. Static, 2. Eternal, and 3. Uncreative. These broad generalizations eliminate the need to even think about a creator god as having any meaningful role to play in anything. However, since Aristotle also believed in forces which he assumed were divine, possibly not wishing to be accused of atheism or impiety, Aristotle posited the existence of unmoved movers, who he explained were perfect beings that had no power to act upon or understand material creation. Despite the absurdity that Aristotle's divinity is ultimately impotent, very few thinkers addressed this absurdity. Using his infamous syllogistic rules of logic, which are also the foundation of all computer coding, Aristotle concluded that since A, the creator, is perfect in his unchanging stasis, it follows that B, the less things change, that C, the more in harmony they are to God. From that sequence of logic, it must be concluded that a lifeless rock were more perfect than organisms of the biosphere, which cause much greater rates of change than non-living matter. Meanwhile, nothing changes more than the human species due to acts of scientific progress, which must mean that we were the most imperfect and furthest removed from God of all creation. If only a wise elite could reprogram humanity to abandon our unwieldy tendency to leap outside our futile mediocrity through acts of creative discoveries, then perhaps we could be remolded to be unchanging, obedient, and thus, quote-unquote, good. Over the centuries, this worldview evolved in form but retained its core assumptions unchanged. Kepler bans Aristotle from Christendom. It is notable that the Aristotelian sleight of hand that turned Plato inside out was exposed by the great Pythagorean astrophysicist Johannes Kepler, who lived between 1571 and 1630, in his 1619 opus Armonici Mundi, Harmonies of the World. Kepler had spent decades proving that the Platonic Pythagorean hypothesis of the harmony of the planets, as outlined in the Timaeus dialogue, was in fact true. In this 1619 book, he proves to be so and demonstrates how he arrived at his third law, aka harmonic law, of planetary motion. In section 4 of this work, Kepler writes of Aristotle, quote, "Where he, Aristotle, draws a universal conclusion and convicts Plato of the stupidity which is his own fantasy, and finally where to the Platonic picture of the self-taught slave he opposes a contrary picture of his own, asserting that the mind in itself is empty not only of other knowledge and of mathematical categories, but also of species, and is just a blank sheet, so that nothing is written on it, but everything can be written on it. From this aspect, I say, he is not to be tolerated in the Christian religion." End quote. Locke and Newton versus Leibniz. In his 1689 essay on human understanding, the British empiricist John Locke, who lived between 1632 and 1704, revived Aristotle's theory of the blank slate, and in so doing defended his notion that slavery was an immutable part of the universe. Locke's thesis that slaves could be legally considered mere property was enshrined in his drafting of the Constitution for Carolina and also justified his own vast shares in the British Royal Africa Company that extracted millions of black slaves from Africa to the British American and Caribbean colonies during his lifetime. In his 1689 treatise, Locke wrote, quote, "The souls of the newly born are empty tablets, only afterwards filled in by observation and reasoning. When does a man begin to have any ideas? I think the true answer is when he first has any sensation. For since there appear not to be any ideas in the mind before the senses have conveyed any in, 'tis about these impressions made on our senses by outward objects that the mind seems first to employ itself in such operations which we call perception, remembering, consideration, reasoning, etc. In time, the mind comes to reflect on its own operations about the ideas got by the senses, and thereby stores itself with a new set of ideas, which I call ideas of reflection. The simple ideas, the materials of all our knowledge, are suggested and furnished to the mind only by those two ways above mentioned." End quote. In drafting the Constitution for the Carolinas, Locke outlined a system of hereditary power and codified slaves as leet men. Quote, point 19. "Any lord of a manor may alienate, sell, or dispose to any other person and his heirs forever, his manor all entirely together with all the privileges and leet men thereunto belonging." Point 22. "In every seigneury, barony, and manor, all the leet men shall be under the jurisdiction of the respective lords of the said seigneury, barony, or manor, without appeal from him, nor shall any leet men or leet women have liberty to go off from the land of their particular lord and live anywhere else without license from their said lord under hand and seal." Point 23. "All the children of leet men shall be leet men, and so to all generations. Every free man of Carolina shall have absolute power and authority over his negro slaves, of what opinion or religion soever." End quote. The idea that anti-Republican John Locke inspired the founding of the United States of America has been a strategic myth which has kept generations of Americans from understanding their own moral roots. Leibniz steps into the fight. For the sake of counterpoint, a leading follower of Kepler during Locke's lifetime was the great scientist-statesman Gottfried Leibniz, who lived from 1646 to 1716, who took aim at the poisonous doctrine revived by Locke's works and dismantled them in the form of a long Platonic dialogue called The New Essay on Human Understanding, finished in 1704, yet only published 50 years after Leibniz's death. Leibniz was particularly well-placed to do battle with Locke's Aristotelian revival due to the fact that, unlike Locke, Leibniz had made genuine acts of revolutionary discovery culminating with his most famous invention of the infinitesimal calculus, a language to chart non-linear physical curves found outside of the abstraction of Euclidean space. Leibniz's logic of physical reality diverged from his rival's due to his commitment to the essential transcendental nature of the constancy of Euclidean abstract forms when pressed upon the discoverable curvature of physical reality. While there is an obvious connection between the two domains of mind and matter, there are also extremely important divergences which can be recognized as soon as anyone wishes to create a circle or square, cube, ellipse, or any other shape within the material domain. As perfect as such a shape may appear, and no matter what refined technology one chooses to use to carry out the task, there is no singular instance that a more perfect straight line, a more perfect square, ellipse, or circle could not be produced. Leibniz and his collaborators like Jean Bernoulli, Christian Huygens, and Pierre de Fermat explored these physical curvatures by observing the pathways traced by planets, comets, and light moving through different media. He also spent much time analyzing the ironical relationship between time and space expressed by the rolling of balls down various curves taken from sections of circles, ellipses, straight edges, or cycloids. Despite the fact that shortest distance between points A and B may appear intuitively to be the quickest pathways for a ball to take, physical reality demonstrates that this is not so. Out of these studies, Leibniz recognized that geometries in reality were best described as least action pathways, that is, nature, when left free to express itself, moved according to a fundamental economy that chose pathways of greatest action with least effort. Another term for this economy of nature was known as the minimum-maximum principle. When asking why planets moved on the pathways they did, rather than some other configuration, the answer for Kepler or Leibniz would not be because they move in ellipses or because their velocity and masses demanded it, but rather that they moved in harmonic least action pathways. More to be said on this below. In his refutation of Locke, Leibniz writes, quote, "Our differences are on subjects of some importance. The question is to know whether the soul in itself is entirely empty, like the tablet on which nothing has been written, tabula rasa, according to Aristotle and the author of the essay, Locke, and whether all that is traced thereon comes solely from the senses and from experience, or whether the soul contains originally the principles of several notions and doctrines, which external objects merely awaken on occasions, as I believe with Plato, and even with the schoolmen, and with all those who take with this meaning the passage of St. Paul, Romans 2:15, where he remarks that the law of God is written in the heart." End quote. Leibniz was consistent in this view and had already been loudly making this point 20 years earlier in his Discourses on Metaphysics, 1686, saying, quote, "Aristotle preferred to compare our souls to as yet blank tablets that could be written on, and he held that there is nothing in our understanding that doesn't come from the senses. This squares better with everyday notions, as Aristotle usually does, and unlike Plato, who goes much deeper." End quote. A World on Leibniz as Cultural Warrior. It is here worth noting that Leibniz was no ivory tower philosopher, but was engaged in frontline efforts to organize leaders to become philosopher kings while also creating cultural institutions to elevate the standards of the culture towards excellence. Some examples of leading figures whom Leibniz found himself advising in grand strategy are Tsar Peter the Great, who made Leibniz Russian privy counselor and assigned him the task of reforming the entire Russian legal system, Emperor Charles VI, who made Leibniz privy counselor to the Holy Roman Empire, the Duke Anton Ulrich, who made him chief diplomat, and Empress Sophia of Hanover, who was a devoted student of Leibniz and nearly became Queen of England, which would have certainly made Leibniz Prime Minister during a period when England was being transformed into a new central command by the Dutch-Venetian oligarchy. In regards to the institutions of science which Leibniz directly founded, we find the Academy of Science of Berlin, Vienna, and even St. Petersburg. Leibniz worked with co-thinkers in China, and was the first Western thinker to popularize Confucian thought into Europe via his journal Novissima Sinica, News from China. Being a devout Platonic Christian, Leibniz was quick to identify the same fundamental concepts of agapic love, pre-existent harmony, principle, and natural law expressed within the Chinese Confucian worldview, and worked to teach his fellow Europeans to think on similar terms as the basis for a civilizational renewal based on East-West cooperation. Leibniz also improved Pascal's calculating machines with new designs that involved performing division, multiplication, and finding roots. This work was inextricably linked to Leibniz's studies of prime numbers, the most anomalous and perhaps powerful of all species of number, which led him to invent matrices. These inventions set the foundation for Karl Gauss's later revolutionary development in non-Euclidean geometries and Riemann's work on hypergeometries. While struggling with the challenge of creating a geometrical language that would be compatible with mapping the universe in the macro and microcosmos, Bernard Riemann had made it known that the key to his success was located in his studies of Leibniz's refutation of Locke. Writing to a colleague, Riemann said, "The most important thing that I read in Leibniz was his devastating critique of the British empirical philosophy of John Locke. What I really began to understand here for the first time is how the human mind works, and what I have to learn and understand in order to do the kind of work I've been trying to do effectively as a mathematician and as a physicist over the past several years." End quote. Taking inspiration from the notation in the I Ching, Leibniz invented binary language which served as the basis for modern computers. A brief, full overview of Leibniz's accomplishments in science, economics, cultural warfare, and geopolitics is outlined in Kirsch's 2013 study, Leibniz vs. Venice. Leibniz battles Newton's irrational God. Perhaps more important than his battle with John Locke was Leibniz's battle with another British empiricist named Sir Isaac Newton, who lived between 1642 and 1727. The fact that both Locke and Newton had worked closely together at the Bank of England is probably not a coincidence. After serving his young niece as a sexual plaything to Chancellor of the Exchequer Charles Montagu, aka Lord Halifax, Newton was rewarded the position of Warden of the Mint of the Bank of England in 1695 and Master of the Mint from 1699 to 1727, where he oversaw the mass execution of counterfeiters and economic warfare that the newly emerging British Empire had begun to wage on the nations of the world. At this same time, Newton was also made president of the British Royal Society, where he moved its headquarters into the square mile city of London, which not coincidentally was and remains the nerve center for global imperial warfare. It was also at this time that Newton led a team of British academicians to conclude that Leibniz had plagiarized the calculus from Newton, despite the fact that Leibniz had published his discoveries of said calculus years before Newton claimed to have invented his fluxion variant. Despite the fact that Newton never explained how he discovered his calculus, and despite the fact that his notation was never used by practical astronomers or physicists due to it being useless, Newton is still taught as either the primary or at least co-discoverer of the calculus to students 300 years later. Since Newton was rarely permitted to speak on his own behalf in public, handlers like Samuel Clarke, who lived between 1675 and 1729, and William Whiston, who lived between 1667 and 1752, often stood in as his spokesman in debates and disputes. In the Leibniz-Clarke correspondence conducted in 1716, Clarke explained that it wasn't necessary to explain how Newton discovered the calculus, since its existence was implicit in the proofs laid out in his Principia Mathematica, 1687. If Newton had not discovered the calculus, then he could not have come up with many mathematical proofs published in the Principia. Thus, had he not discovered the calculus, then it must be presumed that the Principia was simply a composite of plagiarized discoveries made by others. But who would have the gall to accuse the great Newton of such a thing? For those who persisted in asking where the evidence of Newton's plethora of discoveries was found, the story that Newton's dog Diamond burned down his laboratory was concocted as an explanation which persists to this day. According to legend, Newton was recorded as having said, quote, "O Diamond, Diamond, thou little knowest the mischief thou hast done," end quote. For those genuine scientists like Royal Society astronomers John Flamsteed or Stephen Gray, who did not accept such bilge but wanted a real answer, Their lives were systematically destroyed by campaigns led by Newton himself, as told in the book Newton's Tyranny, The Suppressed Scientific Discoveries of Stephen Gray and John Flamsteed by David H. Clark and Stephen P. H. Clark. Towards the last year of Leibniz's life, the great scientist took aim at the most destructive outcome of the Newtonian mechanical system, which presumed a universe of slowly winding down like a clock. Newton's mechanistic system would be the first expression of a theory that later came to be dubbed entropy in the late 19th century, with which we will soon deal in greater depth below. In short, the Principia presupposed a dying universe and irrational or impotent creator devoid of any wisdom. The Principia also presumed objects floating within empty space, moved about by forces of attraction, acting in absolute time without any need for causal metaphysics, aka reason for things being arranged the way they are rather than otherwise. The idea of a dying universe, implicit in the Newtonian model, additionally carried certain implications about the creator of said universe. For if God, who is presumed to be all-wise and all-good, cause of all, created a machine that required its artificer to periodically rewind it every so often after it decayed to heat death, then that would imply an incredible, embarrassing design flaw. Must not a perfectly wise and perfectly creative God who made us in his image not also have had the foresight and power to create a universe that could self-perfect without winding down like a clock or automata? Leibniz wrote, quote, "I am not saying that the material world is a machine, a watch, say, that runs without God's intervening, and I have pretty strongly insisted that the things he has created need his continual influence. But I do say that the material world is a watch that runs without needing to be mended by God, otherwise we would have to say that God changes his mind. In fact, God has foreseen everything, and for anything that might go wrong, he has provided a remedy in advance. There is in his works a harmony, a pre-established beauty. This opinion does not exclude God's providence or his government of the world. On the contrary, it makes it perfect. A true divine providence requires perfect foresight." End quote. In the homogeneous concept of empty space extending in three infinitely linear directions, which Newton presumes as self-evident, there is a rejection of the idea that any harmony and purpose of all parts to the whole universe need exist. It denies the idea that orbits of planets must be arranged around suns due to harmonic reasons, as Kepler had discovered and rigorously demonstrated between 1609 and 1619. It denies that the nature of things are created as they are for a moral principle, which Leibniz maintained must be the case if God were presumed to be both all good and all wise. Within the course of the debate, the devil's advocate Samuel Clark asks Leibniz, "Must not your universe of self-perfection deny mankind his free will? What account must be given for evil? Since evil exists, and since God created all that exists, must it not follow that God created evil? If all is foreseen to this best of all possible worlds, then does that not also mean that human beings either have no free will, or that evil itself is necessary, and thus wise and good?" Leibniz puts the paradox to Clark in the following terms, quote, "When two options are absolutely indifferent, meaning there is nothing to choose between them, there is no choice, and consequently no election or will, since choice must be based on some reason or principle. A simple act of will without any motive, a mere act of will, is a fiction. It is contrary to God's perfection, chimerical and contractor, inconsistent with the definition of will." End quote. In short, the universe is the best of all possible universes, not because of its static perfection, as the Leibniz haters a la Voltaire maintain. Throughout his writings and his life's political efforts at the established philosopher kings across Europe and Russia, Leibniz clearly attests that it is best of all possible worlds, not because it is perfect, but rather because it can always be made more perfect. From Leibniz's standpoint, it is humanity's access to free will that causes evil to exist, and it is because of our ability to participate in the process of universal progress that demonstrates that God is both loving, reasonable, and good. This is at the heart of Leibniz's dynamics, which hinges upon his profound concept of vis viva, a yearning for all matter to actualize its potential to the fullest extent possible, also known as living force, as well as his monadology. It is only when we make the mistake of projecting our uncreative, corrupt irrationalism onto God that evil finds its political expression in oligarchical systems of governance, the way Newton's God is more of an irrational tyrant than anything else. This oligarchical delusion was portrayed brilliantly by Verdi's treatment of Iago's credo in his operatic rendition of Shakespeare's Othello. Sadly, upon his death, Leibniz's potent method was buried, and the myth of the proto-god Newton increasingly became legend throughout the courts of Europe. Generations of thinkers were trained to use Newton's rules for reasoning if they wished to be considered respectable scientists and permitted entry into the halls of esteemed scientific academies. Removing mind from the universe. Among the most destructive rules of reasoning demanded by the Newtonian way were 1. The mind's enslavement to sense perception, empiricism, and 2. The denial of hypothesis formation. Together, these two rules carved the creative soul out of the scientists, leaving only cold logic bounded by the 5 senses. The mind that believes it must adhere to such rules of thinking are in truth merely handicapped in the same way that victims locked in Plato's cave could access nothing more than the shadows cast by puppet masters on the cave wall. Such mind slaves would be forever condemned to believe these shadows to be all the reality that exists, and only the intervention by one who learned to escape the cave and trained their mind's eye to look upon the light of the sun, aka reality as it is, could qualify to become a true philosopher and potentially return to help his or her fellow cave dwellers escape their shackles. In the preface to his Principia, Newton explicitly states his objection to the use of hypothesizing, saying, quote, "I have not been able to discover the cause of those properties of gravity from phenomena, and I frame no hypotheses, and hypotheses, whether metaphysical or physical, whether of occult qualities or mechanical, have no place in experimental philosophy," end quote. Newtonian science took a major blow with Benjamin Franklin's creative discovery into electric fire and its magnetic nature in 1752. The electric spread of new discoveries across continental science repeatedly proved the superiority of anti-Newtonian methods that embraced the more fruitful Keplerian-Leibnizian method of hypothesis formation, rigorous metaphysics, and dialectic. Such discoveries were exemplified by the brilliant work of figures like Lavoisier, Carl F. Gauss, Abraham Kästner, Alexander Volta, and Alexander von Humboldt, to name but a few. But despite this creative potency, the Newtonian stranglehold was preserved through several novel adaptations which were created between 1776 and the present. The Newtonian roots of today's liberal world disorder. As Alistair Crook recently observed in The World Doesn't Work That Way Anymore, the new school of political economy generated by philosophers like Adam Smith, John Locke, and Rousseau premised their systems of social management upon the science of Sir Isaac Newton. In his insightful essay, Crook writes, quote, "The liberal order rests on 3 pillars, on 3 interlocking, co-constituting pillars. Newton's laws were projected to lend the Anglo-economic model its dubious claim to be founded in hard empirical laws, as if it were physics. Rousseau, Locke, and their followers elevated individualism as a political principle, and from Smith came the logic core to the Anglo-American system. If each individual does what is best for him or her, the result will be what is best for the nation as a whole." End quote. The concept of forces of the marketplace premised itself upon hedonistic, pleasure-seeking, atomized creatures called humans, which seek only to maximize pleasure and avoid pain. Attempting to project an image of scientific authority, this new liberal system situated its roots and even core assumptions upon the deeper oligarchical philosophic current stretching from Aristotle, Hobbes, Locke, and Newton. Once again, entire systems were assumed to be the sum of parts in zero-sum games with individual elements of the machine, humans within a marketplace, competing with each other in a Hobbesian battle to maximize profit without any concern for the whole. In his 1759 Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith is explicit on this last point, saying of man and God, quote, "The administration of the great system of the universe, the care of all rational and sensible beings, is the business of God and not of man. To man is allotted a much humbler department, but one much more suitable to the weakness of his powers and to the narrowness of his comprehension, the care of his own happiness and that of his family, his friends, his country. Nature has directed us to the greater part of these by original and immediate instincts, hunger, thirst, the passion which unites the two sexes, the love of pleasure and the dread of pain, prompt us to apply those means for their own sakes, and without any consideration of their tendency to those beneficent ends which the great director of nature intended to produce by them." End quote. This definition of a bestialized humanity would persist throughout all of Smith's writings, including the 1776 Wealth of Nations, and would also demand the existence of magical, hidden hands that acted like occult forces to generate creative wealth whenever the sum total of hedonistic urges were kept unbounded in an unfettered marketplace. Throughout the 19th century, in opposition to the explosions of scientific discoveries that empowered humanity to leap beyond the limits to growth and the closed system thinking of Thomas Malthus, David Ricardo, and other imperial thinkers, continued to promote the notion of an uncreative universe bounded by absolute limits and thus subject to laws of diminishing returns as population levels increased. Such thinkers asserted that God created the human species so incompetently that he forced the elites periodically to cull useless eaters to solve overpopulation. The Anglican Reverend Thomas Malthus, who lived between 1766 and 1834, was most explicit in this view, writing in his first edition of the 1799 essay on the principle of population. Malthus says, quote, "We should facilitate, instead of foolishly and vainly endeavoring to impede, the operations of nature in producing this mortality. And if we dread the too frequent visitation of the horrid form of famine, we should sedulously encourage the other forms of destruction which we compel nature to use. In our towns, we should make the streets narrower, crowd more people into the houses, and court the return of the plague." End quote. A little later, Malthus even argued for the early extermination of poor babies who were of low value to society when he said, quote, "I should propose a regulation to be made declaring that no child born from any marriage taking place after the expiration of a year from the date of the law, and no illegitimate child born 2 years from the same date, should ever be entitled to parish assistance. The infant is, comparatively speaking, of little value to society, as others will immediately supply its place." End quote. Among the opponents to this satanic current of thought rampant among the European oligarch class which Malthus served, the American intellectual tradition of Christian humanism had found one of its strongest champions in the person of the great economist Henry C. Carey, who lived between 1793 and 1879. Carey's Leibnizian economy versus Malthus's dismal science. Throughout his 40 years of published works and political organizing inside the United States of America and internationally, Carey, who went on to become a leading advisor to Lincoln during the Civil War, recognized that limits to population growth potential could always be changed by encouraging advanced rates of progress in opposition to the Malthusian genocidalists of the British Empire. Reflecting the essential dispute between Leibniz and Newton 150 years earlier, Carey eloquently exposed the Malthusian fraud in his Unity of Law as exhibited in the Relations of Physical, Social, Mental, and Moral Science, published in 1872. Quote, Mr. Malthus was led to invent a law of population by means of which to relieve the rich and powerful from all responsibility for the existing state of things, giving them assurance that the poverty and wretchedness by which they were everywhere surrounded had resulted from the fact that the Creator had sent upon the earth large numbers of people for whom he had provided no table at which they might be allowed to eat, no materials by aid of which they might be clothed, thus furnishing the theory by aid of which subsequent writers have been enabled, as they supposed to prove that, in the British Islands, man had become a drug and population a nuisance, end quote. Following the Leibnizian current that saw an economy of nature itself to constantly renew itself with creative progress without limit, Henry C. Carey outlined a system of infinite perfectibility within his two most influential works, Unity of Law and Harmony of Interests. Just as Kepler attacked Aristotle, and just as Leibniz attacked both Locke, Aristotle, Descartes, and Newton for the crime of denying the immortal soul to mankind or wisdom to God the Creator, so too did Carey attack the system of Malthus and Ricardo on similar grounds. Carey noted that God must be assumed to be either irrational, non-existent, or outright evil to have created a species so defective that it must be periodically culled by an elite class to keep them, quote, in balance with the mathematical equilibrium of nature. Carey recognized that these Malthusians denied the principal character of humanity which distinguished our species as above all other known species of the biosphere, the power to make qualitative, willful discoveries and transform our relationship with the entire universe. This is a power that is both expressed individually and efficiently across multiple generations. Among the most essential of these effects is the power to create more energy than we consume over time, which no watch or machine can accomplish. Carey wrote about the interconnectedness of the one, powers of mind, and two, the powers of nature. Quote, the more his power of association, the greater is the tendency toward development of his various faculties, the greater becomes his control of the forces of nature, and the more perfect his own power for self-direction, mental force thus more and more obtaining control over that which is material, the labors of the present over the accumulations of the past. End quote. Carey recognized that political economy as a highest of both the arts and sciences was slowly emerging into human thought, and he knew that this power of coordinating humanity towards coherent goals carried with it a great power for destruction and abuse if oligarchists of a Malthusian persuasion were to capture the levers of its influence. Carey outlined his understanding of this new science in the following passage, quote, political economy, as now taught, is in a position closely correspondent with that occupied by astronomy before the days of Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo. There, too, must it remain until its professors shall qualify themselves for furning answers to the simple questions, whence comes the idea of value, and of what does value consist? End quote. Where Carey and his collaborators placed value on the power of human creative thought, which gives the human species a unique power and duty to leap beyond the limits to growth in the process of acting as co-participants of universal creation, his enemies saw value in the worshipping of money and acquisition of property, which included other people. In order to counteract the optimistic spread of this science and political economy as understood by Carey and his co-thinkers around the world during the later half of the 19th century, much effort was made to reinforce the closed Newtonian system and its Malthusian corollaries to a new science that came to be dubbed entropy. The Origins of an Entropic Idea. Taking the legitimate discoveries of the French scientist Sadi Carnot, who lived between 1786 to 1832, whose work on heat-powered steam engines and thermodynamics revolutionized industrial engineering and design, certain mathematicians saw in Carnot's work a viable model upon which the entire universe and human nature could be described. So what did Carnot discover? Carnot began with the obvious fact that all machines can be treated as closed systems, with parts that move when fuel is burned and heat created. The heat makes all parts of the machine move towards a designed effect. Carnot observed that any heat-powered machine will always burn more energy than is created over time, and that this heat will always move irreversibly from hot to cold until a state of thermodynamic equilibrium is attained. At this point, the machine operator must add more fuel, or else the system will not return to life. This is perfectly reasonable for any closed system. The problem arose when certain mathematicians decided to take this localized phenomena and extend it to the whole of creation as a law which was presumed to bound all of space and time. The personality who did the most to popularize the notion that the entire universe, like Newton's clock, was irrevocably designed to wind down into a heat death of total entropy was Rudolf Clausius, who lived between 1822 and 1888. In an 1865 treatise which popularized what became the second law of thermodynamics, aka entropy, Clausius wrote of the two constants shaping the dead universe, quote, "If for the entire universe we conceived the same magnitude to be determined, consistently and with due regard to all circumstances, which for a single body I have called entropy, and if at the same time we introduce the other and simpler conception of energy, we may express in the following manner the fundamental laws of the universe, which correspond to the two fundamental theorems of the mechanical theory of heat. 1. The energy of the universe is constant. 2. The entropy of the universe tends to a maximum." End quote. In Clausius' theory, the universe became co-equal to a heat-powered machine, which was assumed to be a closed system bounded in space and time with a limited amount of energy to sustain all moving parts contained within it. Thus, the more moving parts existed, burning this limited energy sustaining this machine, the inevitable reduction of energy was available to sustain the system as a whole. States with low entropy were presumed to exhibit high potential for change, while states of high entropy had low potential for change. A simple example of a system's change from low to high entropy could be seen during the first moments of a spray can placed in a fire pit within a large room. The gas molecules increase in speed as the heat and pressure increase. The can explodes. In that first split second, there is a minimum entropy because there is a maximum amount of activity animating all gas particles. With every passing second, the molecules cool and slow down as they spread across the large room and slowly settle to resting positions. When all heat has dissipated and particles have settled, we have arrived at the state of maximum entropy where nothing new will ever happen. The end of history of the molecules has been reached. The application of this model to the universe in the mid-20th century gave rise to the Big Bang model, which took a naive reading of extra-galactic redshifts, blueshifts, and posited that the entire originated in a single point of zero volume 13.7 billion years ago. Before this imagined moment, there was nothing, and all existence has been expanding from that time into an infinite expanse of nothing. Once this expansion has ended, it can then also be presumed that an infinite nothingness will return forever. Depressing and irrational, yes. But if you happen to be an existential nihilist looking for a reason to avoid using your conscience, then it may appear to be a warm comfort blanket. One particularly notable mathematician who jumped on the nihilistic bandwagon with a zealousness usually reserved for religious fanatics was young Cambridge apostle named Lord Bertrand Russell, who lived between 1872 and 1970. In part two, we will see how Bertrand Russell became a high priest of new religion of entropy as the fundamental immutable law of social, physical, and economic science. In that location, we will see how Russell's acolytes used his Principia Mathematica, published between 1910 and 1913, to set the stage for a new science of managing humanity as if the species and all creation were merely closed system computers within computers. The name of this new pseudoscience was cybernetics, and from its poisonous soil grew such ideologies that hid their evil assumptions behind the veneer of moral virtues. Some of these dominant systems were dubbed transhumanism, ecologism, information theory, and systems analysis.